Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, and a deep dive into Renaissance textiles.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first, we'll go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. America's top diplomat has said there's agreement between the US and its Arab allies on the need for an immediate and sustained ceasefire in Gaza. Antony Blinken was speaking in Cairo after talks with senior ministers from Arab countries, which he described as productive. Our correspondent Tom Bateman, who is travelling with Mr. Blinken, looks ahead to the next phase.
Antony Blinken heads to Tel Aviv Friday morning, and it's going to be, I think, a moment of the Americans putting pressure on the Israelis over those key issues, flooding more aid into Gaza amid the humanitarian crisis, and also about their objection to a full-scale ground assault in the city of Rafah. So a relationship that is often described as ironclad, I think we're going to see a moment of more stress points emerging on Friday.
A senior UN official in Haiti has warned that the criminal gangs that control most of the capital, Port-au-Prince, are advancing into new areas of the city. Meanwhile, political leaders are continuing to negotiate steps towards forming a new government following the resignation of the Prime Minister last week. Will Grant reports.
The UN's humanitarian coordinator in Haiti, Ulrika Richardson, described the situation on the ground as moving from very worrying to extremely alarming. Specifically, she blamed the extent of the humanitarian crisis on a combination of political instability and rapidly worsening insecurity. Ms. Richardson described the actions of the National Police in Haiti, who are tackling the gangs, as heroic, but said they were struggling to be present across the city while the gangs advanced into new neighbourhoods. However, even such urgent updates from top UN officials inside Haiti appear to make a limited difference in terms of either the aid response or a political solution.
The former leader of Catalonia, Carlos Puigdemont, has announced he will run in the Spanish region's snap election in May. He's been living in self-imposed exile in Belgium. Here's Guy Hedgeco.
Carlos Puigdemont announced his candidacy from the French town of Elne, just across the border from Spain. For the last 7 years, the Spanish judiciary has been trying to prosecute Mr. Puigdemont, who is a member of the European Parliament. However, he could benefit from a controversial amnesty law for Catalan nationalists, which is expected to come into effect by the second half of May. The former Catalan president has returned to the spotlight since his Together for Catalonia party supported the investiture of Spain's socialist prime minister, Pedro Sánchez, in November.
The president of Botswana has criticised proposed legislation in Britain to ban the import of trophies from hunted endangered animals, including elephant tusks. Mokgweetsi Masisi said there had been no attempt to understand the impact a ban would have on his country. He described the move as hypocritical, as Britain allows the hunting of stags and exports their antlers. World News from the BBC. European Union leaders meeting in Brussels have agreed to keep working on plans to buy weapons for Ukraine, with profits from hundreds of billions of dollars of frozen Russian assets in Europe. But the 27 leaders stopped short of approving the proposal. Reports suggest that Hungary, which has close relations with Russia, said it wouldn't support the plan. The US Justice Department is taking legal action against Apple, accusing it of crushing competition in the smartphone market. The lawsuit says the company has illegally used its monopoly power to hurt its rivals. Michelle Fleury gave us the reaction from Apple.
Apple has a couple of weeks to kind of review the complaint. They say they're going to vigorously defend themselves. They deny the allegations. Most likely what we will see is them try to get the case dismissed completely. And the reason they believe they have grounds for that is that if you think back to the 90s, there was a big famous antitrust case against Microsoft at the time. It had 95% control of the global market. In the case of Apple, globally, it has about 20% control of the global smartphone market. Here in America, domestically, about 60%. And so they're saying, well, does that meet the threshold of a monopoly?
16 Republican-led U.S. states, including Texas, have filed a lawsuit challenging the Biden administration's ban on new permits for the export of liquefied natural gas, or LNG. The Texas Attorney General said the ban was illegal, damaged the U.S. economy, and would limit supplies of LNG to European allies. A Supreme Court judge in Brazil has rejected a request to halt the arrest of the former international football player Robinho, who's been sentenced to 9 years in prison for rape. On Wednesday, a Brazilian court upheld the conviction handed down to him in Italy 2 years ago for the gang rape of an Albanian woman at a nightclub in Milan. That's the latest BBC News.
This is Marcus Slayton and Christina Leffering with your local news coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines.
United States Senator Ron Johnson promoted Russian disinformation, a former associate of Rudy Giuliani told a congressional committee yesterday. Senator Johnson did so, according to Giuliani's associate Lev Parnas, in an effort to discredit Joe Biden in the run-up to the 2020 election. Parnas told the House Oversight Committee that Johnson and several other lawmakers knew the accusations they advanced were false, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The committee is investigating whether there is evidence to warrant impeaching Biden. An aide to Johnson called Parnas's statements baseless. In 2022, Parnas was sentenced to 20 months in prison for fraud and campaign finance violations.
Governor Tony Evers took action on a slew of election-related bills today. Evers signed bills to bolster protection for election officials and bar municipalities from abruptly closing polling places within 30 days of an election. But the governor also vetoed several other bills, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Those bills include provisions that would have required special elections to fill uncompleted terms of vacant constitutional offices, place election observers no more than 3 feet from workers counting ballots, bar poll workers from assisting voters in nursing homes and under other long-term care, and required the Legislative Audit Bureau to review the conduct of every general election. Evers vetoed that last provision, he says, because state law already requires election commissions to audit election processes.
At a WIS Politics event on Tuesday, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss accused a right-wing political action group of exploiting a loophole in state lobbying laws. Voss was referring to the group Americans for Prosperity, which was a leading lobbyist arguing against a bill to regulate construction of electrical transmission lines. Voss alleged that Americans for Prosperity is a, quote, prime example of lobbyists spreading falsehoods being paid for by somebody out of state, unquote. The so-called right of first refusal legislation would enable owners of transmission lines in the state to build new lines without having to bid for the project against out-of-state competitors. Utilities and labor unions lobbied in favor of the bill, which passed the Assembly but was not taken up by the Senate in the legislature's most recent session. Americans for Prosperity State Director Megan Novak criticized the bill as, quote, anti-free market cronyism that would unfairly drive up energy costs for Wisconsinites, unquote. She also stated that the group complies with Wisconsin's lobbying laws.
A plan to build a natural gas-fired power plant has run into opposition in the city of Superior, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The city's plan commission has recommended that the city deny approval to build the Nemadji Trail Energy Center, a 625-megawatt plant. But an attorney for Minnesota Power said the utility and its partners can build the plant without the city's approval, pointing out that the state's Public Service Commission already okayed the project. Superior's Mayor Jim Plain says he expects the utility to respect the city's final decision. If not, he said, quote, we'll see you in court, unquote. The power plant, which will replace coal-fired generators, has its supporters in the area, including the Duluth and Superior Chambers of Commerce, local trade unions, and the Enbridge Pipeline Company.
Madison's snowfall this winter is well below average, by about 14 inches, according to the National Weather Service, but the number of winter weather parking tickets has gone up. Every year, the winter parking rules go into effect on November 15th and end March 15th. And this year's citation numbers are in. A total of 8,337 tickets for winter weather parking violations. The city issued approximately 6,700 fewer tickets last winter and the winter before that. So why are this year's numbers so much higher? The city largely suspended winter parking enforcement in the snowy months of 2020 and 2021, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Last October, Parking Division Manager Stephanie Cox stated that the city was looking to ease the financial burden on folks already struggling with pandemic-related stressors. Cox also says it's difficult to predict how winter weather will shake out in the coming years, but that she expects alternate side parking citations to stay lower than what was issued a decade ago. In the winter of 2014 and 2015, the city issued a whopping 27,120 winter parking citations.
Starting next year, Madison High Schools will no longer have early dismissals on Mondays. The district made that announcement to parents in an email earlier this week. The district's middle and lower grades take first students' yellow buses and will continue the early release schedule next year, but Madison High Schoolers ride Metro Transit buses. According to the district's email, the city's bus service can't accommodate early release amidst its changing routes and schedules. In order to retain federal funding, Metro's transit schedule is required to be consistent across the board, so the city will have to run the extra early routes release early every weekday year-round. That's not feasible, reports the Wisconsin State Journal, because it would bump up operating costs and exacerbate existing staff issues.
Those were the headlines. And now, on to the rest of today's top stories.
Last month, Madison residents had another chance to voice their concerns about the noise from F-35 fighter jets at Truex Field. These and future meetings are being funded by a grant from the U.S. Department of Defense. Reporter Sarah Gabler has an update on the situation.
That's the sound of an F-35 taking off. The audio was captured by sound designer Ethan Bordeaux for the soon-to-be-released documentary film The Quietest Year, which documents the lack of noise regulations across the nation. For some time now, Madison's north side has been anything but quiet due to the sound of the F-35 jets at Truax Airfield. The Wisconsin Department of Military Affairs has been hosting town hall meetings with Madison's north side communities in an attempt to address concerns. They recently announced plans to host three additional neighborhood sessions between March 21st and 23rd, but facilitator David Burrell says there wasn't much interest in these meetings.
We offered it out to people to host smaller discussions, either one-on-one or small group discussions. To be honest, we didn't get much uptake on that. So we have a couple set up, meeting with school representatives and some neighborhood people, but we're using the opportunity to do a little bit more background research.
The last round of community input meetings took place in early February. At that time, participants expressed their concerns about their physical and mental health, as well as property values. Here's one community member at the February meeting.
There are concerns about homes losing their value. We had a comment that the initial information was that flights would fly during certain hours, and this doesn't seem to be accurate. There's a concern that there's no noise abatement issues at all coming from the either the military or the county airport.
Another attendee at the listening sessions asked for the Department of Military Affairs to create an app that would notify residents of the F-35's arrivals and departures. Other attendees raised the issue of redirecting military transit aircraft to Volk Field, about 80 miles north of Madison, for refueling. The next round of listening sessions is meant to gather more feedback from community members who did not attend the first round of listening sessions because either the meeting times and locations weren't clearly communicated or because communities of color weren't directly engaged. The meetings are being facilitated by a global consulting group called Future IQ. This group is responsible for community outreach, engagement, and education on behalf of the Wisconsin Department of Military Affairs. Future IQ is being paid over $47,000 for these efforts, Wart found through an open records request. This money comes from a nearly $800,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Defense to the Wisconsin Department of Military Affairs. There are about three more months left on Future IQ's contract, which runs from July 2023 to June of 2024. The stated goal of the project is to build a stronger relationship between the Madison community and the 115th Fighter Wing. David Burrell, the CEO of Future IQ, says the money is being put toward a few things.
Well, that funding portion is to help design and facilitate community engagement. So that includes things like the project portal, which we have up and running. It includes the initial community listening sessions. It includes some of these ones that we're doing this week. It's the longitudinal study going out soon and various elements.
The Department of Military Affairs has not yet released information about how the remaining $750,000 of the federal grant will be spent, though these funds are stated to address noise mitigation. A U.S. Air Force environmental impact study on the F-35s from 2020 found that there would be significant change in the noise environment in the surrounding areas that would disproportionately impact low-income and minority populations as well as children. Noise is also a concern in light of Madison's ongoing housing crisis. A 200-page draft report on how to mitigate the noise of the jets released in February by the Dane County Regional Airport projects that the F-35 fighter jets will affect future development of areas around the airport. Specifically, the noise of the jets could limit what could be considered for future residential development, even as the city scrambles to add housing in a city projected to grow by over 115,000 by 2050. The new noise exposure maps could limit the number of future residential developments in areas around Truax Field, where the noise contour exceeds 65 decibels, about the sound of laughter up to a sound of a vacuum cleaner. Averaged over a day, though, noise above 65 decibels can have negative impacts. And under FAA standards, anything above that noise contour is incompatible with residential living, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. There are more than 1,200 residential housing units that already exist within the noise contour, as well as a church, a daycare facility, a school, and what the report terms transient lodging. The draft report also finds that some multi-use structures with a blend of residential and non-residential uses would not be eligible for noise mitigation like sound insulation. Under the report, that includes schools, places of worship, libraries, daycares, and transient lodging. Meanwhile, the city has recently outlined proposed future land use plans that would add more affordable housing to areas around the airport. That draft Northeast Area Plan is one of the city's first under a new urban planning framework. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Sarah Gabler.
Wisconsin policymakers have long discussed the need to help underserved communities access high-speed internet service. The state just got some good news in applying long-range planning, with a big chunk of federal funding coming into play. Advocates for older residents are voicing their relief. Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection has the story.
Wisconsin has announced a big development in trying to establish more digital equity around the state. Governor Tony Evers and the Public Service Commission say Wisconsin's blueprint for digital equity has been accepted by the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. That means the state is eligible for up to $30 million to implement its approach over the next 5 years. Martha Cranley, State Director for AARP Wisconsin, calls it a robust plan, noting that older populations continue to face challenges in being connected to the digital world.
We know that at least 15% of people 50 plus in Wisconsin are not connected, either because the wires simply don't come to their house, or they don't have a device, or they don't know how to use it.
Cranley says the lack of connection is especially concerning in rural areas across northern Wisconsin, where aging communities have limited resources. Stakeholders also note an infusion of new aid is helpful with the federal government's Affordable Connectivity Program, which provides discounts on monthly internet bills for eligible households in danger of running out of money. Cranley says the state's plan came together following extensive public outreach, in which her organization helped convey the need for improved internet access for those 50 and older.
They certainly heard from older people about how important this is to connect to their doctor and to connect to government services and, frankly, find employment.
Overall, Governor Evers says the plan's federal approval means more than 410,000 homes and businesses will be better positioned to be connected to new or improved high-speed internet service. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
It's now 6:21 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. In less than 2 weeks, Dane County voters will decide on who sits on the county board. District 28 represents Cross Plain, Mazomani, and the surrounding area. And two candidates are vying for the seat, incumbent supervisor Michelle Doolin and challenger Bill Brocious. Earlier this week, Brocious spoke with WORT News producer Faye Parks to discuss his priorities for the district.
Thank you for joining me, Bill.
Glad to be here.
So to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background and what political experience do you have?
So I have a master's in business. I've been in management for well over 20 years within the IT world, medical world. I have been on the Cross Plains board as a village trustee for 7 years. That's an elected 2-year term. I was elected for 3 terms, and then I was appointed for 1 year. I have been on the library committee. I've been on the Cross Plains Barry Fire District. I've been on and continue to be on the planning committee in the village of Cross Plains as well. Also, I have volunteered most of my life living here in Cross Plains. I've lived here for about 32 years now, and I volunteered with Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, Girl Scouts. I was a Cub Scout leader. I was a Boy Scout Scoutmaster and leader. I got involved with the scouting within the county level as well. A lot of community service, a lot of community activities, as well as my political background.
What brought you to run for the county board? What are your priorities for District 28?
The biggest reason I'm running is because I look at my tax bill in 2023. Dane County raised our taxes nearly 14%. And over the last 4 years, they've raised our taxes cumulatively over 32%. Spending has gone up over 32%. Our debt's gone up 67%. I looked at all those numbers and I said, you know, we have to bring a little bit more common sense into Dane County and prioritize what we're spending our money on. That's my biggest priority, is to look at the fiscal avenue within Dane County, what we're spending our money on, make sure that we're prioritizing the right things, making sure people are getting the help that they need, but let's do it correctly. Let's not overburden our residents. I've been knocking on doors for about 3 or 4 weeks, Faye, and I knocked on this one woman's home in Black Earth, and she was like 78, I believe. And she's really worried that she's going to be taxed out of her home. She's lived in that home for over 50 years, and she keeps looking at her tax and what she's got to pay year over year, and she's like, they're going to drive me out of my home. And she's very, very concerned about that, as many people are as well. We, Dane County, need to keep a better handle on what we're spending our money on and what we're asking our residents to pay their money towards.
Are there specific areas within the latest budget where you could see room for more cuts, areas where you think spending hasn't been appropriately careful?
I got 2 areas. One was Dane County is giving $2 million to Ho-Chunk for a Ho-Chunk museum. you know, we have homeless, we have hungry people, we have people that are, you know, at risk of losing their homes. I don't think the Ho-Chunk Historical Museum should have been a higher priority to give $2 million of residents' tax money to. It just seems there are better ways of spending our money. Another issue is for capital. We're spending $892,000 on a facade at the City County building and for windows and lights. I don't know all the ins and outs of why we're spending $892,000 for that. It just seems pretty excessive, where, again, we could be using that money to help support more people in need than the outside of a city county building. Our municipalities are doing the best they can. Black Earth, Cross Plains, Mesomanie, the towns, they're controlling their budget and making sure that they're fiscally responsible. We have the school districts, which, you know, is part of our property taxes as well, and Madison College. All of those accumulate into our taxes. And sometimes a municipality or a school or whatever may go up or down, and that directly affects our taxes. But Dane County is the only thing I would be able to affect. That is really going to be my biggest focus.
So I know that criminal justice reform is a big talking point this year. What is your perspective on that?
I think there is a wave of doing the right thing and not categorizing everybody as a criminal, right? Some people may have mental illness issues. Some people may have drug issues, and those cannot really be a criminal issue. Those could be more of a disorder that we, the community, would have to treat. And that's not something a individual department can do. I think we need to collude with other agencies, health officials, the community leaders, police, and work together to try and help those people and keep those people out of the criminal justice system. There are criminals that belong in the criminal justice system, but there are people that are just struggling with life and could use more help medically.
Meanwhile, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi's retirement is around the corner. What are your thoughts on that race? And if elected to the county board, how would you handle that transition?
I can't control that race. And I think whoever wins that seat, they really need to be mindful of not just a minority of people within Dane County. Obviously, we have a large presence within Madison and the surrounding cities around Madison. We also have a rural area, which really needs attention as well. About 80% of our population is urban. The other 20% of our population is rural. And the people that I've talked to in the rural areas feel like their voice really isn't heard. And so whoever comes in to replace Mr. Parisi really needs to focus, I think, on not just the urban issues that are going on within Dane County, but also the rural issues. Farmers need a break. Farmers are struggling day after day, and they feel like they're getting pressured more and more to do more with less. And so I think the next Dane County executive should look at that and find out what they can do to ease some of the burden from our farmers and help them prosper. Because what we don't want is we don't want to lose the farmers that we have within Dane County. We want to keep as many farmers as possible because it's important for our food. It's important for our environment. That's one of the things that they could focus on.
Before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Just, you know, be mindful how the budget is set up within Dane County right now. It's about 39, almost 40% goes to health and social services. About 21% goes to public safety and the courts. 10% of our budget goes to our debt services, you know, the money that we owe. Right now, looks like in 2024, Dane County is going to have debt of $667 million, which is up from $350 million 4 years ago. Again, it's important that we are out there helping our neighbors, helping people that need the help, but it's also important that we try and be fiscally responsible at the same time as well.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Bill.
Thank you, Faye. I appreciate your time.
That was Bill Brocious, one of two candidates vying for the District 28 seat on the Dane County Board. District 28 represents Cross Plains, Mesomanie, and the surrounding area. Brocious says if he wins the seat, he'll advocate for more careful spending to reduce pressure on taxpayers. We heard from his opponent, incumbent supervisor Michelle Doolin, earlier this week. You can listen to her interview on our website. Doolin and Brocious will face off on April 2nd.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Please stay with us. We've got lots more stories coming up.
We'll hear more from Michael Johnson, CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, and we'll take a deep dive into Renaissance textiles.
But first, we'll take a quick break, check in on some world headlines, and we'll be right back.
With the BBC News, I'm Roisin Hasty. America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, has said there's agreement between the US and its Arab allies on the need for an immediate and sustained ceasefire in Gaza. The US says it will bring a draft resolution to the UN Security Council on Friday that ties the need for an immediate ceasefire with the release of hostages held by Hamas. The BBC has confirmed that a spokesman for Israel's prime minister was suspended because of a dispute with the British Foreign Secretary, David Cameron. Alon Levy publicly criticised a recent social media post by Mr. Cameron calling for more aid to be let into Gaza. A senior UN official in Haiti has warned that the criminal gangs that control most of the capital, Port-au-Prince, are advancing into new areas of the city. The United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator for the country, Ulrika Richardson, said a huge number of people had been displaced trying to escape the violence. The former Brazil international football player Robinho has been arrested to serve a 9-year prison sentence for rape. He was convicted in Italy for his part in the gang rape of an Albanian woman at a nightclub in Milan in 2013. The former leader of Catalonia, Carles Puigdemont, has said he will end his self-imposed exile if he's chosen as the region's leader in snap elections in May. Mr. Puigdemont faces jail if he returns to Spain. European Union leaders meeting in Brussels have agreed to keep working on plans to buy weapons for Ukraine with profits from hundreds of billions of dollars of frozen Russian assets in Europe. But the 27 leaders stopped short of approving the proposal from the European Commission. Botswana's president has criticised proposed legislations in Britain to ban the import of trophies from hunted endangered animals, including elephant tusks. That's the latest BBC News.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton, here with co-host Christina Leffering. Thanks for joining us. Boys and Girl Club supporters and mentors Dane County's young people with the help of volunteers and generous supporters. In this edition of Out of the Box, feature contributor D-Star has more from Michael Johnson, CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. In this excerpt of their conversation, Johnson shares the stories behind some of their latest events and projects.
So tell us some more about this partnership with Little John's.
You know, we've always have fed our kids healthy meals at all of our clubs for at least the last 15 years I've been here. So I said, you know what? Why don't we look at outsourcing that? Little John's is feeding kids and families all over the city. Right now, they're doing all of the Meals on Wheels. They're feeding kids at the Children's Museum. So we met with them and said, hey, can you provide a chef in all of our kitchens at Boys and Girls Clubs and then utilize your equipment in our clubs and bring your nonprofit into our kitchens and run it all out of Boys and Girls Clubs? And they agreed, you know, to wow. do that. So to have full-time professional chefs in our kitchen preparing meals for our kids is a blessing. And, you know, with the rising food costs, one of the things that I love about his program, he works with some of the local grocery stores like Metcalf's. Actually, I was with them last night. And so some of the food that they use, it's not that it's bad food, but it's recycled food that like farmers may not use. They go back.
Kind of like imperfect.
Yeah, yeah. Like it's almost like somebody may sell a pair of gym shoes, but it's a scratch, a little bit
of
small scratch on it, right? He recycles that food. And then instead of selling it, he's like, Little John's will go out and prepare meals, whether it be for hospitals or for, you know, nonprofit organizations. And so we've asked them to come and partner with us to provide about 30,000 meals a year for our kids.
Wow. Let's go crazy event. Now, I know the theme is Prince, right?
Yeah.
Purple Rain Prince. Yeah, yeah. I actually was Purple Rain Prince for Halloween this year.
Where are you?
Oh, I killed it.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
So how did you come up with the idea to have this whole event based around Prince?
Yeah, actually, it was not my idea. It was we got some amazing, talented people who work on our development team. So they proposed the idea to me. And so let's, instead of like every year we try to do something. They know I don't like chicken dinners, right? Everybody in this city have fundraisers and it's the same old boring chicken, gravy,
little rice.
String beans, like little rice. Like I get so sick of going to those kinds of events. So we did a Gladys Knight concert a couple of years ago. So they always know that I'm looking for something different. So they said, we should bring Prince. I'm like, Prince is dead.
Right.
And they were like, no, it's a cover band. They showed me his videos. I was like, oh, that's dope. So we're going to bring, I think he's a young Italian dude, but I saw about 20 of his videos.
And he on point.
And he on point, man. I was like, he was killing it. He got a whole band. So we're going to do a little concert. We were thinking about bringing in Deion Sanders. I had been talking to Deion's camp, and he had agreed to come, but he wanted to come, like our event is on a Friday night. He wanted to come on Saturday, but we had already booked the event. And then Deion wanted a plane because he doesn't fly commercial. So I had to find one of my donors who had a plane, and they were willing to go pick him up, but he wouldn't fly a single plane. So I had to find a plane that had like two passengers, like two pilots in it. So I put it out on Facebook, and sure enough, one of our donors in Middleton had a plane that would accommodate that. So then the dates didn't work out. And so hopefully if he's coaching next year, when he's coaching.
Come on.
Well, the question becomes if he's coaching in Colorado.
Here we go, man.
Or if he's going to be in the NFL. You just never.
Here we go.
You never know, man.
The man said what he said. He said he's not going nowhere.
Everybody say that. But sometimes the right opportunity come, and you may not have the intentions then, but a little bit of resources, a little bit of money, and a little bit of some other things might alter that decision sometimes.
Yeah, you're right. So tell us about this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful center that you got here.
Man, it's amazing, man. I remember this.
Because we're in a boardroom, right?
Yeah, now this is what we call our entrepreneurship room. This is the room where we teach kids about financial literacy, how to put together business plans, teach them about assets and liabilities, teach them about marketing. All that happens in this space. And so years ago, John McKenzie had asked me to come out to Florida to meet with him and his wife. And I really did not want to go. I didn't know them that well, but it ended up being the best decision I ever made recently in my career.
Really? So, that's saying a lot.
Yeah, it was, I don't like really spending the night at people's houses. And that I don't really know. So they're like, oh, come to Florida, come hang out with us, blah, blah, blah. So I get down there and I got a hotel. And they're like, well, why are you going to stay at a hotel? Come stay at our crib. So they live in this gorgeous home in Sarasota, Florida. And I get there. And I was like, well, we'll see how this goes.
But you still got the hotel as a backup.
No, at that point, I canceled it. So
you was going out on the limb.
I was just going out on the limb. And so I get there and they end up being the most down-to-earth people I ever met. So we stayed up all night laughing, just like talking about politics, talking about social issues, talking about everything. Mm-hmm. And then that next day, we went walking on the beach. Then we went bike riding. And then I was so impressed with their house. I was like, man, I want to bring my family here. And so they had agreed. And so I got four people in my family. And I remember FaceTiming my sister in Chicago. We were in the swimming pool. So they stay out this late off the ocean. Mm-hmm. They have a pool right off the ocean. It's the most gorgeous thing you ever see. So I ended up FaceTiming my sister at like, I think it was like 8 o'clock. By midnight, I had 22 family members from Chicago in that house.
Wow. So they hopped right in the car.
No. They took a night flight from Chicago to Florida. And so my wife was like, Mike, they only allow, you do realize this is a predominantly white neighborhood.
Right.
And they're going to see 20-some black people in this house. You might want to just give them a heads up.
Right.
So I was like, man, maybe I shouldn't have invited my family. So I called, and my wife was listening. I said, well, I got a few people here with us. My wife, and she wrote me a note. She says, not a few. We have a couple dozen.
Right.
So I said, yeah, I got a, some family, and they didn't mind. And so I just realized, man, like, I remember leaving that house, their house that weekend, and they wrote us a $100,000 check to help one of our kids go to college. Like, it was, I think to this day, it's probably one of the largest singular scholarship ever given to one student.
Wow.
And they pay for her housing, her tuition, and some other things. And that's when I knew that they were really the real deal. But what he asked me during that time, he said, look, I love what you're doing to help black and brown kids graduate from high school and go on to college. But what about kids who don't go? He said, I've made millions doing real estate. We need to teach young people about business. We need to teach young people about how to become plumbers, carpenters, electricians.
Because we really need that.
We need that, and it's a way for them to earn a living at a very early age. So he was like, we should go find a building. And then so he bought this building for $1 million. So then we started talking to some architects, and they were like, we should gut the whole building out and turn it into what you see now. But it was a $10 million price tag. I had only raised about $50,000. I'm like, how are you going to come up with $10 million? So we sold the plan to the city. And within 16 months, we raised $35 million.
Wow.
So this building is completely paid for. And then we created an endowment that helps sustain it in perpetuity.
That was Out of the Box host D Star and Michael Johnson, CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. You can hear the rest of their conversation on the Out of the Box podcast.
It's now 6:41, and you're listening to live local news on WORT. An exhibition titled Remaking the Renaissance is currently on UW-Madison's campus. As the title suggests, it focuses on textiles dating back to the years between 1400 and 1700. Dr. Sophie Pittman is the Pleasant Rowland Textile Specialist and Research Director for the Center for Design and Material Culture. In this episode of Radio Chipstone, Dr. Pittman tells feature contributor Jennifer Fields how historians can use textiles to better understand the Renaissance period.
This particular chasuble that is from the Helen Louise Allen Textile Collection is something that I was excited about before I ever even visited Wisconsin. Before I even visited the state, I was becoming enamored with this object. When I applied for this job, they asked me to pick three objects from the collection and do a little teaching demonstration based around them for one of my tests in the interview process. And I picked this piece, and the reason being was not for what it is or is on the outside, but for what is lying beneath the surface of it, which is a very intriguing way to say that it's a chasuble made for a priest in the Roman Catholic Church to wear, probably when administering mass or doing another high service. He would have worn it over probably much more simple gowns, white, long, floor-length linen gowns, probably. And the exterior pattern is a very typical pattern for this period, sort of late 16th, early 17th century, symmetrical florals in red and white and yellow. But what's inside it, the lining material, are these really beautiful, if stained, Perugia towels. A Perugia towel is an object that was woven in Italy in the sort of Umbrian Perugia region, out of linen and sometimes cotton, simple white linen with these beautiful bright blue dyed strips that decorate the edges of it. And this one is decorated with lots of beasts, so birds, trees, and then the debate is out for what these animals are. Some people say deer or griffins or horses. I've had giraffe. I think giraffe is unlikely. I don't think
that's a stretch.
Known of giraffes in this period. But essentially, these are very fine table linens, tablecloths. that were used in the domestic sphere across Europe, associated with Italy, but certainly used all across Europe, as a very fancy tablecloth or something to wash hands with. The church also used them as altar cloths or hand washing cloths during the Mass or during other celebrations. But what's fascinating to me about their use as a lining material in this garment is that by the time they were put into this chasuble, probably in the 16th or 17th century, they were at least 100 years old.
I always think of garments for churches, for cathedrals, particularly something that would have been part of a ceremony, as being pristine, mm-hmm. but there's evidence of wear and tear. Do we know enough to know if the priest would have worn it in this condition, or is this the result of it being stored for so long?
That is a good question, and probably a mystery we might never, at least in our lifetimes, be able to solve. This came to the collection with very little, basically no provenance. So I don't know exactly where this is from. I can't tell you the church or the community. What I can say is that what I think this represents is actually a more common picture of textiles in the period than we might be led to believe often by museums.
I don't know if I shared it with you, but I scoured the museum looking for paintings that had evidence of visible mending, and I found one.
Oh, cool. I want to see that.
But it was a scene of mm-hmm. war, and it was a commoner who had like tools for hunting. Oh, cool. And so that was my thought, because I'm thinking, how prevalent would these materials have been? How difficult would they have been to get? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're using 100 and something year old fine linen to repair something, that kind of tells me that having this stuff laying around wasn't common.
I think the church was engaging in a practice in this garment that lots of people would have done. You know, textiles in this period are incredibly valuable. People expect to have a textile in many different forms across their lifespan and maybe for future generations. So people are spending much larger proportions of their income on textiles. Don't forget, everything is handmade at this time, made with natural materials, and transforming fiber into thread already is labor intensive, let alone weaving it and dyeing it and making it into a beautiful garment. So there's a lot of work in here. But work is relatively cheap at this time, but the materials themselves also have value. So people lived with textiles for far longer than we do now. They expected to, maybe once they had been finished with them in their garment that they were wearing, remake them into something for their children or sell them on the secondhand market, or even take them apart into their component materials and sell those materials. So that's partly why not everything survives from the period. It was worn and worn and worn again until it was worn out or sold and or melted down if it had metal in. The colorant could be extracted from the dyes. I mean, really, they did not waste a thing if they could avoid it. So, you know, I think partly this is a survival of a church that's not a really, really rich church. The congregation is probably more working class, probably. We have to guess that. It might well be also that all of the textiles that we see in this piece were already in their second life, in their second form, when they were made into a garment for a priest. So when you come into the exhibition, you're confronted with really the fanciest textiles that you could get in the period. Really complicated woven velvets dyed with super expensive Kermes dye that was extracted from lice. So these are very, very rare and fine dye stuffs.
Stop. Lice. Some term for something else Lice.
Scale insects, that's right, insects that make red. Just like cochineal does, and in fact Europeans were starting to get cochineal from what they called the New World, from the Americas, but mostly the brightest reds were coming from these little tiny insects that you could get in Eastern Europe. Absolutely beautiful, bright reds, very, very potent, and restricted in many parts of Europe to only the top elites. So there were laws in place called sumptuary laws that legislated who could wear what. Secondly, anything that you're not seeing that's red here is metal.
You know what? I would call you a liar, but I know you well enough to know that that's not the case. Come on now.
So metal wrapped thread was a huge part of the luxury textile production in this period. The problem is that the reason this is so hard to see that it's a piece of metal is that now that metal is tarnished. So we've all experienced, if you have jewelry in your collection, that you'll, you know, open up your jewelry box and a silver necklace will be kind of black and it will rub off on your fingers. That's what's going on here. Most of the metal in this textile was not pure gold, and so it's tarnished and rubbed away. So some of it we're seeing the metal thread has come loose. This one patch here that's really sparkly gold is pretty much pure gold. That's why it's not tarnished. You know, this is 500-600 years old and it's still really shiny. But the rest of it was probably a mix of, you know, it's not pure gold, it's like gilt. Maybe part of it is silver. You could do scientific testing on this and find out. But these two pieces are also a chasuble, a far fancier chasuble than the one we were just talking about over there. And yet these are not in their first form either.
There seem to be seams that aren't necessarily matching on both sides.
Oh no.
So yeah. I'm looking for evidence, because I'm all about the visible mending. I don't know if you heard Carolyn and I when he was screeching about visible mending, but I've really been thinking about visible mending and reusing and remaking my own garments. And I'm looking in here and I'm seeing seams that kind of, they don't line up. The part that has the gold in it, that doesn't have as many seams as the one that's across from it. So do we know if this is from the same treasure bowl? Is this a couple of them? Or is it bits and pieces of things that were culled in order to create this as it sits to wait? Because I'm guessing it would have been used again because it's so precisely cut out.
That's right. I think what we're seeing, and again, these stories are largely lost in text, so we have to use the material evidence to hypothesize what we think is the history of this object. What I think has happened is that this textile originally was not in the church at all. I would imagine that a wealthy member of the elite had this beautiful multi-height pile, velvet with gold. This motif is called pomegranate, a pomegranate textile. We see actual pomegranates depicted. They would have had huge pieces of it. It's a massive pattern, big pattern repeat. And they could have used it to furnish their home or palace, or as a big cloak or gown, something that would really show off these giant petaled, you know, kind of fantastical flowers and vines. Now, this would have been really the most expensive and complicated textile that money could buy in the period. But once you were wanting to redecorate your home or get a new cloak, there wasn't a huge market for these textiles. They were very valuable, but don't forget, most people are not legally allowed to wear this.
That's what I was going to say. You have very, like, I can take the objects that, the clothing, the garments that I no longer want and donate them to a women's shelter. Let's just pretend that I was the woman wearing this.
Why not? Yep.
I couldn't have done that. It would have been regulated who I could have given it to.
That's right. So you could have extracted the, you could have sold this and somebody could have extracted the metals, literally melted them out. Metal itself is valuable. And they could have extracted the color too. They could have turned this into a pigment and used it for a painting. And we know that was done. And sometimes when they test pigments in oil paintings, they'll see tiny little bits of silk in there. And we'll know this wasn't originally a pigment. This was originally a piece of cloth. So you could extract value from this. But the other thing you could do was donate it to your church. And so the church would receive something, a really, I mean, hugely valuable textile like this. But if it was in the form of a cloak or just big bits of yardage, they would have had to, you know, work with what they had. And so I think what we're seeing here is some quite thrifty piecing of probably what we're looking at here actually is two panels from the front of a chasuble. We're missing the entire back. So maybe they kept most of the pattern itself for the back, and then all the little scraps they just made into a composite of, you know, what are we getting here? Like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on this side, maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 patches on this side. I think this is quite shocking to modern eyes because when you stand back, it's so obvious that the pattern, it's not symmetrical. They haven't tried to line it up. That one we were just looking at before, some parts of the pattern are upside down. You know, they can't pattern match. They have to work with what they've got. And so when fine textiles survive, like these ones do, we're often not seeing them in their first state, or maybe even second or third state. We're just seeing them in the state that they were preserved in before they entered the market and were sold to collectors or given to museums. So typically, Lot does survive from the church, because churches are lovely, dark, cool places that where textiles survive quite well. And the church no longer wears things like this, partly because of criticisms that were levied during this period in the Reformation, where people were very unhappy that their priests could wear this and they could not.
So then, Sophie, as we're looking at these, are there specific techniques that allow these things to survive? What is sort of like the technique for preserving these? Would the visible mending be a sign for the church that we have taken this garment and we've used it to the best of our abilities? Or is the visible mending truly just, we've got to get this thing together and we've got to make the best of this? Because you would think, I would think, if a church that's facing criticism for being so extravagant, it would be sort of a feather, again, pride in my cap to say, yes. Well, we're reusing these garments. Can't you see how this is beautifully crafted by who knows where from wherever?
Yeah, probably nuns or women in the congregation. Yes. I love the way you're thinking. This is what I would like to think, too, about this garment. So the way that a chasuble is cut, you can see the lining even when it's being worn, because the back is way wider than the human body. And in the exhibition, I've got a picture up, a beautiful Rubens painting, a little reproduction of it, that shows you that you can see very clearly the lining of a chasuble when it's being worn. If whoever the priest is wearing it has got his arms up, you can see right through. So I think, absolutely, they knew this would be seen, and there's a couple of things going on when it's seen. I think definitely a church that's being looked at, scrutinized for its spending on luxury materials, is doing a very wise thing by making it very clear that they're lining their garments with old altar cloths, old beautiful towels. But I also think what's going on very specifically with these examples, these Perugia towels, is that these are really valuable but relatable domestic textiles. They would have been used in people's homes, but also the church used them for altar cloths, for washing hands, you know, in the part of the communion when the priest has to prepare things. And what we see, more of these Perugia towels survive in depictions in paintings than survive in material form.
Interesting.
So now I've told you about them, you're going to spot them everywhere. In most paintings of Italian homes, especially where we're seeing depictions of like Christ's birth or, you know, lovely, beautiful sort of domestic scenes, but where religious figures are present, you're going to start seeing these towels everywhere for wrapping baby Jesus's body. I've got a reproduction here in the gallery of a crucifix scene where it's wrapping as a loincloth. So I think what's going on is really complicated. I think they're partly showing that they're being thrifty and reusing things. But I also think there's a kind of spiritual humility with putting an old altar cloth, one that is so suitable for wrapping Jesus Christ in, right next to your body. So I think that there's all kinds of things going on in this garment, and it's communicating very explicitly to its congregation a number of things that are both spiritual but also economic and political.
And that's a wrap for WORT's Live Local News at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer. Your reporter tonight was Sarah Gabler. Special thanks to feature contributors Dee Starr and Jennifer Fields. Super Dave Lorenz engineered the show, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Ms. Shally Pittman is the news director here at WORT. Thank you guys for listening. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffring. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Have a good night.
Hi, my name is Vicki Kenyon. I'm your host for this week's Access Hour on WORT Madison, and I am a connector. I have always loved connecting people with one another and connecting people to resources. As I dove into my second career as a realtor, I found that much of the queer and trans community on a national level is not connecting to homeownership in ways that the rest of our country does. I want to change that. My aim is to make a significant positive impact on queer and trans home ownership here in Dane County. So, after a lot of networking and a lot of planning, I gathered a team of four other professionals and launched a free educational series that provides resources and answers to questions around home ownership in an inclusive, welcoming, and safe space. And now, we bring our knowledge to you here. On this week's Access Hour, my team and I will be here talking Homeownership 101 and answering your questions live.
You're listening to Community Radio WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Are you passionate about community music and local voices? I'm Jay Davis, and I'm thrilled to share an exciting opportunity with you.
I'm Tom Davis, a proud member of the programming committee at WORT. We're the heartbeat of Madison, shaping the airwaves with diverse, engaging, and community-driven content. But to keep the beats flowing, we need your help.
Since you're listening to WORT right now, you may be aware of this, but this is more than just a radio station. It's a platform for local expression, a hub for artists, and a stage for community voices. Join our programming committee and become a driving force behind what goes on our airwaves.
Whether you're into music, news, culture, or something entirely unique, we want your voice in the mix.
Visit our website at wortfm.org/programming-committee, or you can email me directly with j.davis@wortfm.org, and we can start the conversation.
WORT, where your voice matters.
You're listening to WORT Madison. I'm your host, Lauren Hicks, and this is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Spring has just sprung, and you may have broken out some gardening tools. Maybe you're considering planting some tomatoes. But what if you could also grow those tomatoes in space? That's what our guest tonight researches, space tomatoes, specifically how tomatoes cope in stressful environments, like space. With me tonight is Dr. Simon Gilroy. He is a professor at UW-Madison of botany, where he researches how plants sense and respond to their environment and how those signals regulate plant development. He's the head of his own lab, the Gilroy Life Science Lab, which tries to understand the root of these processes on a cellular level. Hello, Dr. Gilroy, and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine.
Oh, thanks for the invitation to come and talk.
I'm really glad you're here. So you're currently running an experiment in collaboration with NASA to see how tomatoes cope with spaceflight. It's called TASTY, short for Trichoderma Associated Space Tomato Inoculation Experiment. So tell us about this experiment.
Yeah, so space is a strange place for all biology to go, not just plants, but, you know, the astronauts are up there. Biology has had millions of years to get really, really good at living